listening. You're terrible at this.
I know, and I'm ending this broadcast. Can you imagine?
He's the worst interview show.
This show sucks. Welcome to the Backpack Show, everybody. What a day today. We're going to space.
I thought you were going to say the weather again. I was so ready for it.
Suns are out. Guns are out.
I am very excited. We're going to talk to Todd Thompson, director of the newly released feature-length documentary Woman in Motion, Michelle Nichols, Star Trek, and the remaking of NASA. It is fascinating. And I really admire Michelle Nichols, and I learned so much about her and the work that she did to make NASA more representative and inclusive. That continues. Her legacy continues to this day, like in NASA. It looks very different than it would without her efforts. And it's kind of amazing. It's just a single campaign they talk about. So anyway, I watched it, loved it. Can't wait to take it all apart. And we have a real astronaut with us today. I'm so excited. Nicole Stott is with us, and we're going to talk about what it's like going to space and also the work that she does in space and how it affects our life here on Earth, because she also has a whole book about research done about the Earth. So,
look, you're not going to believe how good her camera looks in space. I think StreamYard should get some extra stuff. Oh, yes, it is the guy from StreamYard. Hello, it is me. So yeah, we got a big show.
From StreamYard.
Movies about space, people from space, something.
Hi everyone, Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, welcoming you to The Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
We did it. It's another fine day. We've brought in people from Vegas and Scotland, Wisconsin, Maine, in space.
You're so funny.
So yeah,
Coach Woodard.
I don't know how to approach this. I mean, I guess we'll talk to Todd about the movie. We'll grab in Nicole and do that. Let's do ads.
We might
ahead
have
of time.
More like together time.
I know we're gonna probably do more panel time than not, but let's do this really quick. Let's do the ads. Speaking to our, is this from StreamYard? Look, StreamYard. See Brogan.me/StreamYard. You can make your own show like this. All you got to do is go out and find guests that you like and are willing to talk to after the show as well.
Ideally willing to talk to, yes. That's what get your doing. Own movie director and your own astronaut.
If you want to not look at us, you can look anywhere there's a podcast. You can download The Backpack Show now. That's because we're hosted on Castos, castos.com. Super easy podcast hosting. Oh, I don't have much to say about that. Hey, you want a .online domain? Because then you could have the foundation .online if you want.
Space for Art Foundation.
You know, Space for Art, if you say it fast enough, could sound like Space
Don't.
For Art.
No.
You know
that's
it.
That's not okay.
We're going to ask all about farts in space. Seabrogan.me/online, 99 cents for that domain. Did I do all my ads? I think so.
So much more.
And so much more. Let's start with Todd, and then we'll bring everybody else. So Todd Thompson, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Couldn't tell you. Seems good.
We'll see how it goes.
You look great.
Science pointy, yes. Woman in Motion. Talk about the project as far as what made this the project that you wanted to donate all this time and energy and juice to.
It was a lot of time. It was just brought to me. I was introduced to the story, I'd say November 2014, believe it or not, that long ago. And it just quickly, immediately resonated with me as this amazing hero's journey. And I'm a sucker for a good story. So, you know, my two producing partners that introduced the idea to me, they're both trekkers, you know, hardcore trekkers and very much involved with NASA. So we kind of had a little shoe in there, you know, as far as it's a little backdoor access and whatnot. But it was really just a matter of a few weeks, you know, actually, let me strike that. It was probably about a month and a half before we were able to, you know, connect with Michelle and get her on board and get her excited about the idea. And the rest is history.
Boy, does she have a presence. I mean, even in moments that were, you know, just kind of in between scenes or something, she really lights up a room.
Yeah, she's, I mean, the best way I always describe her is she's truly like Hollywood royalty. Extremely gracious, extremely humble, and it just has a magnetic presence that just really engages you from the minute you like just connect eyes with her, you know.
I thought that it was really interesting to learn that she was about to leave Star Trek the show because she wasn't getting a lot of lines, which is frankly noticeable. If you go back and watch, you're like, they should give her more. And I understood her frustration, like as an actress, as a performer wanting to work on her craft. And then Martin Luther King was like, absolutely not. Like, you can't leave. You can't leave.
Yes, Mayor. It's funny. She always describes Star Trek as like the show that got in the way. You know, she was en route to Hawaii for a live performance, you know, a live stage gig, when she had to make a pit stop in LA, and that she instantly fell in love with LA. So she decided to, you know, settle there on her way back. But yeah, TV and it was definitely not her first choice medium of performing. She was always, you know, thought herself as a stage actress, a dancer, performer, singer, and you know, and rightly so. So when TV and then of course eventually Star Trek came up, those were always just kind of like little sidesteps for her in her mind. You know, little did she know that, you know, it would be this role that she would carry with her entire life.
So crazy.
As recently as I was looking at IMDb because I was trying to remember what her character name was in Heroes, and as recently as 2020, like she's got film credits for another Star Trek project in 2020. So that's like, it's pretty intense that it's kind of made it its way this long. Yep. When making a film like this, when making any documentary film, there are always so many ways into a film. There's always so many ways that you can kind of frame the story. You have to think about, you know, what do I want to get done? How do I get the pieces I need for this? How do I get a lot of good B-reel? How do I you know, make this, you know, shaped the way I want? Are there any parts where you're like, forget it, we're going to do it a different way? Or were there kind of approaches you were going to take that you didn't? Talk to us a minute about sort of like assembling the film.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You know, it was my first documentary. I love documentaries, of course, as a viewer, as an audience participant, but I never made one before. So, you know, you approach a documentary similar but very, very different than you would a scripted, you know, feature film, if you will. And, you know, I guess what we had going for us was this was a piece of history. We, you know, we knew the beginning, middle, and end, if that makes sense. So it helped us, you know, when outlining the story and, you know, what was going to be act one, what was going to be act two, what was going to be act three. It helped us determine, you know, the people we were more than likely going to have to reach out to talk to help tell the story. We had some concerns early on because, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the people that were either directly involved or worked, you know, directly with Nichelle during this time are no longer with us or unable to participate anymore. And just because of their age or health reasons. So, you know, we you know, up until the 11th hour, we actually had a gap, a story gap, you know, during that time. She actually went on her recruitment. And it wasn't until Dr. Carrie Joles, you know, emerged from the shadows that we were able to fill that gap. And so he was a godsend just to find him. But, you know, it kind of attests to the fact that, you know, even though it took us 5 years to make the film, I'm glad it took us 5 years because had we gotten done in three or, you know, even four, we would have missed Dr. Joles. You know, we would have missed so-and-so to talk to. And so, you know, the approach was very very specific, but also very, it's like, it was like casting a wide net. You know, we knew exactly, you know, pinpointing which interviews we wanted to get, but we also didn't know. So we had to cast a wide net, you know, as far as like what kind of B-roll or what kind of content or additional footage we would need. And that's just, I guess that's just, you know, me getting into director mode and just trying to forward think, you know, what I'm going to need in that edit room. You know, 6 months after we're off the road and we're in this dark room and we're trying to put all these pieces of a puzzle together. So a lot of it is proactive thinking, a lot of it's proactive planning, but then a lot of it's just shooting in the dark as well. No pun intended.
Like, see what you get.
Yeah, exactly.
Todd, you have a lot of background. You've done a lot of writing for a lot of shows and pieces and things like that. You have a lot of acting credits. You're a pretty hefty working guy in the entertainment space. But this, like you said, is your sort of first directorial, you know, your first documentary this way. How much, you know, the whole 5 years to make it might be the answer to the question. How different was it from, you know, anybody could do this to, oh gosh, like, this is, what did I do? Like, how much energy goes into you realizing maybe this isn't as easy as I thought it was going to be?
I mean, you have challenges, but, you know, to be very frank, we had a great team and, you know, we were all there to support each other. You know, I took the forefront as director, if you will, but, you know, you got great producing partners and people to rely on and bounce ideas off of. And then, you know, you quickly learn, and I'm sure Nicole will attest to this too, just, you know, with her line of work. I mean, there's always a solution to the problem, you know, there's always a way to get it resolved or work your way around something. So, you know, I don't ever find myself getting stressed out. Like, you know, we just blew it or we just wasted, you know, XYZ or amount of money or whatever it was. I mean, because there's always a way around it. There's always a method to the madness. So, yeah, I don't know. It was a good experience, really, from beginning to end.
We know problems in space are bigger than problems on Earth. So there's a whole skit of that. Yeah.
SNL. Yeah. Problems in space.
No.
I'm going to put a little reverb behind that. Space.
Exactly. So did you, in this process though, and coming to this, does this wet your whistle for, I'm going to do another documentary project, or are you like, forget it? You know, I'll just write some pieces.
No, I'm extremely busy right now. We have, I'm about three quarters of the way through another documentary called Prefab, which is, the story of the birth of Beatles, actually. Really fascinating story. Just getting started on a rock and roll documentary about Del Shannon called The Runaway. And then there's a very long-term project, longer than 5 years. It's a 15-year project for me called The Highwaymen, which is both a feature film and a documentary series that we're working on. So there's a lot going on right now. So, you know, it's been nice to sort of complete Woman in Motion and send it out into the world and let the world enjoy that. But definitely the things have been busy in the back of the house too.
Coach Woodard has a question. What's the biggest lesson you learned in making the documentary?
What's the biggest lesson I learned? Just to always be open, you know, always, you know, even though you think you have an idea or a sense of direction, always be open for, you know, what's next or something you're not, especially with the documentaries, you know, a piece of information or a nugget that you're just either not aware of or that kind of changes your direction a little bit. And just to be able to stay flexible enough to embrace that and to make the most of that. Cause these are the things that, cause your, you know, really direct and guide your story.
I was really impressed at some of the archival things you found and the way that things kind of hung together, like you tied things together. And one of the things that came through was just Nichelle's grit and resourcefulness, because there were a lot of times people really didn't, that people she was talking to recruit for NASA, like really didn't want more minority or women represented in NASA in the ranks. They really didn't want that. And so she faced a lot of uncomfortable, but in sometimes it's even dangerous situations. And she always found a way around it. Like she didn't stop at any point. And the work she did was just incredible. So looking at what you did, I was thinking there must have been times too that you were like, gee, I'm not getting what I need. I can't tell this part of the story, but you kept at it because it's all there. So what was something that you had to kind of regroup and keep going after to find?
Well, I mean, really, you know, going back to that whole recruitment campaign, those 4 months on the road, I mean, the whole movie's about, you know, her mission and her 4 month campaign to recruit astronauts. And, you know, again, up until the 11th hour, we knew we had a gap there, and it's, you know, a little daunting, a little frightening to think that you're making a movie that you can't really, you don't have the content for to tell 100%. So we were always, you know, our wheels were always turning, like, how can we communicate? How can we visually show that portion of her life, you know, which is, you know, the crux of the movie, when we don't have either the right people to talk to, or we can't seem to locate, you know, or the people are no longer around, you know, that were there with her when she was working on that portion of her mission. And so again, it's a lot of patience, a lot of faith. It's a lot of open, just being incredibly open-minded to just different ideas and different options and just seeing where all the chips fall, really.
Todd, I had one question. In researching this, one thing I noted was that IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes call this a 2019 movie, but it also says released for streaming and theaters in February 2021. So is there that gap, or was it released and then re-released? Like, I just don't understand them.
We had this gray period of a lot of sneak peek screenings, if you will. So early on, when we had just had an initial assembly of the film done, we were invited to be the opening night film for the Florida Film Festival, the 2019 Florida Film Festival.
Wow.
So, it absolutely was not a premiere by any means. It was almost like a first look. I think they called it a first look because it truly was the first time audiences were going to get to see the film. But it was a really cool experience for me as a filmmaker because, number one, it was extremely well received. I think it was the first, I know it was the first Florida Film Festival in 29 years at that point, where they sold out like three full houses. So we literally were bouncing around between theater to theater doing the intros and the Q&As and all that. They had to stagger the screenings because the popularity was so strong. But it was a great chance, at that stage in the production or in post-production to, get a chance to share the film with an audience in a dark room and hear the feedback and know what was working, what wasn't working. So 2019, we had a series of those, starting with Florida, and kind of made it around the festival circuit a little bit, just giving audiences a chance to giving us a chance to test the film and giving audiences a chance to experience it and seeing what sort of impact it truly had on people.
Man, it's dynamite. So if you're watching this and you haven't watched the film, you need to. It'll make you feel like, yes, it'll make you feel like, what am I doing that's this important? Nothing. And then you'll have to go do something.
You'll have to do something mega.
Yeah. That's important. That's one of the things I wanted audiences to take away. No matter who you are, you have the power to make a difference, and just be focused and devoted to something you truly believe in. And it's amazing, the results.
Yes. And it wasn't just representation for women and minorities on a show in space. It was really in space. Like, that's where it went.
That's the thing that keeps being exciting, is that the ripples, the fact that, Nextel phones flipped because communicators flipped, and like all the different people who took engineering and, science jobs and all that because of the smart, strong women there. It's amazing. What an interesting segue that would be to pulling an astronaut into our conversation. I mean, that would be weird, right? So this is my first
fun one, I guess.
We're lousy with how many first-time documentarians we get around here, Todd Thompson, but we don't have a lot of space ladies. So Nicole's
They're not space ladies. That's probably the worst.
I think space ladies is a perfect name.
No. I think I'll have to yellow card you for that. Hang on.
Yellow card Brogan. What else is new?
I made myself think of Lando Calrissian because it just sounds like a thing he would have said.
I would have yellow carded him too.
Nicole Stott, welcome, and
thank you
for being part of the show today. So glad to have you on.
So this, I'm sorry in advance.
Now I'll tell you, there's worse things that could follow the word space than lady. So we'll take it.
Yes, that's true.
That makes you wonder. So you were on the ISS expedition 20 and 21. Mm-hmm. You did a lot of flying around, tooling around the world, all that sort of thing. And then
she's
now
doing
you're
valuable and important work in science.
I don't know
what space ladies flying around.
All right, well, let me ask this question. Here we go. I'll get me off the hook, Astro Nicole. What's a typical mission? Like, what was a mission that you did that, either may or may not sound really important, but boy, it's the execution is intense because it's a little up higher.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, I think it's the reason why any of us want to go to space is because we know that there's really important work going on. And in the end, all of it ultimately is about improving life on Earth. Right. And my missions, I had two. The first one was what we would call a long duration mission. I flew up on the Space Shuttle Discovery, spent a little over 3 months living and working on the International Space Station, and then came home on the Space Shuttle Atlantis. And then a little over a year later, I traveled back to the station, to and from on the Space Shuttle Discovery. It was the final flight of the Space Shuttle Discovery, and we were only there for 2 weeks, which I can tell you, I will not complain about 2 weeks in space, but it's not long enough after you know how wonderful it is to live there for months at a time. But every day is different. And I think that's what's so cool about it, is the primary role is certainly the scientific, investigations that are going on, but just learning how to live and work in space with each other, how to create this mechanical life support system in space that we build to mimic as best as possible what Earth does for us naturally. And then these relationships that we've developed. I mean, for over 20 years, we've been living and working as a crew that represents 15 different countries in space as one crew, just peacefully, successfully doing that. And I can tell you, it's a really wonderful model for how we should be living and working as crewmates here on Spaceship Earth. Yeah. Ramble.
Sorry, I didn't want to kind of. So I was thinking about when you first imagined yourself as an astronaut, like when you pictured yourself in space, because I'm thinking of Nichelle Nichols and her legacy and Woman in Motion, and how there just weren't any women doing that visibly. You know, there were like women working behind the scenes to support research and science for NASA and all that stuff, but none up front and none going up. So when did you first aspire?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, my whole life, actually, I think it was maybe an aspiration, but not something I believed could be possible, right? And not because anybody told me I couldn't do it, but just, it seemed like one of those things that was like, oh, other special people get to do that. Why would they ever, you know, pick me? And it had nothing to do with whether I was a, you know, a boy or girl or any of that. It was just, wow, that just seems too special to even consider. Which is why, and I'm so thankful that Todd and his team have included me in the, you know, in kind of the commentary about this film, because, you know, I was getting ready to graduate high school in 1980. So 1978, when that first group of astronauts that was this like blend of humanity was coming to life for the space shuttle program, I don't know, it just became something that became more believable, right? That other people could do this. And I knew I always wanted to work with things that fly. I wanted to know how things fly. And if you want to know how things like airplanes fly, why would you not want to know how rocket ships fly? And wanted a job with NASA that then later evolved into, holy moly, 99.9% of an astronaut's job is not flying in space.
What?
It's here on Earth. I know, it's a surprise. You know, about 80% of it, as best I could tell, was a lot like what I was doing already as a NASA engineer. And I'm like, man, maybe I could consider it. And then it really took talking to people that I consider to be mentors to encourage me to do really just the one thing. Like I have one here, I still use them, you know, to pick up the pen and fill out the application, the thing I had control of. And I think, like Todd said, you know, there's this, you know, there's this kind of this need to believe that things are possible, right? There's this need to believe that solutions exist for really challenging problems, and to really be willing to put yourself out there right in the middle of that. And sometimes that takes the encouragement of somebody who believes in you to, you know, to push you that way. And that's, I mean, I think that's what happened for me.
I think there's a lot of people don't realize astronauts have to be able to do something. They're like, I just want to be an astronaut and go to space. It's like, you have to be doing something up there. So what's the something going to be?
Yeah, it's definitely not all about the adventure of it. I'll tell you, I highly recommend it for, you know, from that standpoint as well. But I don't think you just strap on to 7 million pounds of exploding rocket engine stuff to because you think it's going to be fun. I mean, I think you really, you need to believe there's some greater good coming from it. And I can tell you, as a mother who had a 7-year-old son on my first flight, you have to know, I think, in your heart that you're doing something that's, you know, good for them too.
Well, the more I looked into it, the more I was surprised to see, like, for instance, you did a whole huge thing in the Aquarius Undersea Research Habitat. You did all these extreme environment trainings. You also have these really bizarro titles that I need you to help clarify, like director of flow. Like, what's that mean? Like, you made sure the mission was groovy, or is that like made sure the toilets work the right way? What does director of flow mean?
Yeah, flow director. I mean, that was really, we have all these things like processing and, you know, like shuttle processing. What does that mean? You know, these kinds of things. But it's basically, I kind of look at it like it was this flow of, and it is groovy. I'll just tell you, I think it's one of the coolest things that you can work on is getting a spacecraft ready to fly. So it's, how do you get that space shuttle that just landed on the runway all taken care of, safe and ready to fly back to the launch pad, you know, ready to go again? And that's really my time at Kennedy Space Center as an engineer and a program manager was about 10 years there. And that's what it was all about, is how do we get these spacecraft ready for the astronauts to fly and to do their mission? And it was, I don't know, just the best preparation for actually being an astronaut one day and getting to fly on those vehicles as well.
I have 8,000 other questions, but I'm gonna limit it to two really quick ones. I have two really quick ones. One is, when you watch those hooligans down the street in their commercial spaceship now, and they're sort of like flipping rockets in the air and landing them again, like it's no big whoops. Like that's going to change the game. Cause like you said, when you get a space shuttle down on the ground, there's a massive amount of process that happens. And it just seems like when Musk and his weirdos just flick a rocket in the air and then land it again, just for a dog trick, like that looks easy. Is this going to change, or is there like a huge engineering gap between what they're doing unmanned and what else we need to do in space?
Well, I mean, the beautiful thing is that they've already started to fly crews as well, right? And some of those people are my very good friends, and so I'm watching what's going on with all of that. I think they have discovered this is a really complex thing to do, to get, whether it's getting cargo to space or crew to space. It is rocket science, right? And I think they've gotten into a cadence with the spacecraft that they had that's allowing us to push things forward, a little quicker. But you mentioned, I mean, the space shuttle was a reusable vehicle as well. It just was a spacecraft that could do everything. And I mean, and do everything in the end really well. There's not many projects where you have kind of the whole, you know, everybody wanting it to do what they want and it coming out as wonderfully as the space shuttle did. So now we're kind of picking the pieces apart. Okay, we want to take crew or we want to take cargo. We want to go further. We want to stay close. I mean, we're kind of breaking it down into separate little pieces, and that's what these companies are doing. And so, you know, a company like SpaceX with their Dragon capsules now for both cargo and crew are able to transport them there and back. And then do really interesting stuff like landing the first stage on a barge or at the launch site after they've done it. And I think it's just going to continue to evolve. The thing I love the most about it, though, is that it's not just SpaceX doing it on their own. I mean, they realize that the support they've gotten from NASA, including major dollars to be able to do this as part of this like public-private partnership right now, is necessary for them to be taking these next steps. And so I love seeing this cooperation going on. And I love seeing astronauts get to fly again from a launch site at Kennedy Space Center. And not just with US crew. I mean, what we've built with the space station is this international partnership, and that's continuing on our spacecraft. You know, we're continuing to fly on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft, which was this, you know, thank goodness they were there during this gap between shuttle and, you know, and new vehicles. And I don't know, these things we're doing with other people from around the world that we do in space, I think it really very nicely tempers some of the things that don't go quite as well down here on Earth between those same groups, and makes it probably a little bit better for us than it would otherwise. Yeah.
It beats the hell out of ping pong diplomacy for sure. Uh-huh. Todd Thompson, one of the things I was thinking while Nicole was talking, and great, because it sort of circle back to Nicole on another part of what she's doing. Women in Space is a great amplification vehicle to remind people that we need more women in the space program and other important science programs. It's you're contributing in this body of work by getting people who are trekkers or people who are now parents to trekkers to say there's a bridge between this fun entertainment and what can really be done here. As you're hearing Nicole talk about that, and I want to hear about your thoughts about the importance of this project, understanding you have all these other interests and all that, but like, do you feel good that you contributed to this sort of storytelling of the importance of women in space?
No, yeah, I feel extremely humbled. Yeah. Before Nicole came on, you were talking about, you know, the old flip phones and whatnot. And one of my favorite days filming the movie was when we were in Rod Roddenberry's office and he had all these, you know, props from the film, from the TV series rather, just displayed, you know, so nicely around the office and everything. But as as I'm just kind of, you know, taking it all in and whatnot, you realize like how incredible, you know, science fiction inspires science and vice versa, you know, and yeah, to your point, you know, they're inside this little glass box was the communication device. And that looked just like my first, you know, Sprint phone, you know, my little flip phone. And I'll never forget, you know, seeing the movie Minority Report for the first time and Tom Cruise doing the whole thing with his hands. And you know, what, within a year and a half later, we had the first iPad and everyone was doing the thing with their fingers. And so, you know, you got to wonder, you know, who's, you know, what kind of conversations are happening in the boardrooms, you know, from a creative perspective, you know, when they're making these movies, like they reach out to companies like Apple and all these, you know, technologically driven companies to kind of start infusing, you know, reality with science fiction and vice versa.
I love that with all the crazy scientific things we saw on those shows, the really revolutionary stuff was the diversity. And everyone's like, yeah, wow, we don't have that, you know, but we got that flip phone out.
But, you know, priorities. You look at it. I remember as a kid watching Star Trek, my dad had it on, you know, every day after school, and just watching it and not just watching it and thinking, okay, that's what people in space look like, you know, and just believing that was, you know, the way the flight deck of a spaceship should look was this mix of humanity. And, you know, and then of course we didn't see that for a while. And thank you, Nichelle, and, you know, NASA for bringing that to life. And I don't know, I think it's cool. You know, there's this whole conversation about like the sci-fi to sci-fact kind of transition that happens. It's out there everywhere. And it works the other way around. You know, Todd, I'm sure you're seeing like where films are, they're reaching out to try to make it as scientifically accurate, you know, as possible too. And then, you know, and then of course we go and watch it. We're like, oh man, we'd never do that if we were in a spacesuit, you know, kind of thing. Cause the drama has to be there in these like feature film things. But, you know, you mentioned SpaceX, people like Elon Musk, you know, you got Bezos doing Blue Origin, wanting to fly things. All of these people, as they were kids, and even now, I mean, they are sci-fi fanatics. I mean, they're trying, I think, to bring to life what they read and saw as kids and what they felt was the, you know, the really most exciting parts of those things. How do they bring that to life and do it themselves? And I think it's really cool. I just, I live with a guy who probably knows more about sci-fi than anybody on the planet. And it's interesting to hear his kind of commentary almost on, you know, when Bezos makes a decision to do something some way and then Musk does it a little bit differently. He's like, oh, they read this author and he read that author. And that's why, you know, why he's doing it that way.
Well, they all read Neuromancer.
Yeah, yeah.
They had to go all the way back.
Yep.
So Carol had a question. Nicole, do you think watching Star Trek with your dad contributed to your fascination with space?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And just, you know, again, going back that, you know, believing that these cool things were possible, you know, maybe watching it and not even knowing as a kid that that was sci-fi, you know, in some ways you're, you know, when you were a kid watching stuff, you're just like, oh, there's this thing called the Enterprise. Like
I wanted a replicator. Yeah, I wanted one. I was like, why don't we have
the transporter is what I want. And, and
that's
then,
what I'm waiting for you.
Yeah, I know. Right? No kidding.
And I'm not going to be the first one. Yeah.
You don't want Scotty to do that. But the thing is, it's like there were other things, I think, just that just kind of branched off of that as well. I mean, my dad built and flew small airplanes when I was growing up. So as kids, we were hanging out at the airport all the time. So flying was just this thing that was real. It was part of, you know, what we did. And yeah, getting off the planet was something that came, I think, a lot through, you know, what I experienced as a kid and believed could be possible.
Coach Woodard had a question too. In the 1960s, the chief space mission was to land a man on the moon. What is the primary space mission for the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, it's to land humans. I'm really excited. It's about going back to the moon right now. I think that's as a stepping stone to take us to Mars. And, you know, NASA right now with the Artemis mission, that's what it's called, like the sister of Apollo, which I think is so cool. And there's I just did this BBC radio show called, it was on for like World Service or something, but the title of it is The Equal Rights Stuff. And of course they mentioned you, Todd, and Nichelle, and the film as, you know, part of what encouraged this this diversity in the program. But had a chance to interview Kathy Leaders, who's the head of all human spaceflight now for NASA. And she said, she was talking to one of her employees one day, one of her engineers, and she's talking about, oh, isn't it so cool that as part of the Artemis mission, our plan and what we're promoting is that we're going to land the first woman and the next man on the moon. And this woman, she's like, that thing just really ticks me off the way we're saying that. And she's like, well, why? And she's like, why can't it be two women? Why do we have to be so prescriptive to say that, well, we'll put this woman and this man on the moon? Why can't it just be two women?
Because spaceflight is between one man and one woman, and everybody knows that. So stop messing with my philosophies.
But I think it's going to be, so Kathy's like, yeah, really, why can't it? You know, every single one of our astronauts is trained to the same level. It doesn't matter, you know, the rocket ship doesn't care if you're a boy or girl, right? And so as we build these missions, we just need to be looking at, you know, who we pick. I like the fact that there is, you know, we know there's going to be a woman stepping foot on the moon on this next mission, but it's cool to think about it that way, that people are actually like, wow, we have crew members, we mix them up the way we need to do the mission.
I mean, that's the only way to get the strongest team. It's like Moneyball, but in space and for real stakes, you know? Elizabeth has a question. What's a small habit change we can do to make Spaceship Earth better?
Wow. I think for me, and I'm sure everybody here has an answer to this, my biggest thing is really figuring out how to live like crew and not passengers. I mean, that's the way we survive on our mechanical spaceship, right? We've built this system in space, this beautiful like space station masterpiece, and we've built it to, like I said before, to mimic what Earth does for us naturally, right? And every day as a crew there, we're acutely aware of how much CO2 is in our atmosphere, how much clean drinking water we have, how that gets distributed across all of your crew members, the integrity of our thin metal hull. That's all like in our minds all the time, as well as, you know, how are my crewmates doing? Is everybody healthy, happy, you know, fed? And I think there's just something inherently purposeful about behaving like a crew member and realizing that you're in space already on a spaceship. It just happens to be a planet. You know, hey, I live on a planet kind of.
It's a killer answer. Todd Thompson, I was thinking something about this. You know, when people are known for their acting roles or something, there's a question that's always asked of actors, which is, you know, when people run up to you, which character name do they shout out? And you know, it's for whichever movie they're known for. Space and Star Trek has kind of a fandom. Like there's a couple of people who like Star Trek still, but you're about to do a Beatles film too. That's another whole different kind of fandom. Which one are they going to yell your name about when they come up and see you in a line at a coffee shop? Which one do you think they're going to, which is going to have the crazier fandom?
That's a great question. I think what I love about all these films is, they each one of them embraces such a special franchise, if you will. You know, like, I mean, when I was doing Woman in Motion, you know, you just knew you were part of something bigger than yourself, because with Michelle and the Star Trek franchise and just 50 plus years of history that goes into that, you know, with the Beatles, it's the same thing. I mean, that music has touched so many different people in so many different ways. And I can't think of a band that's been, you know, I guess explored and dissected as much as the Beatles. But what attracted me to this particular story called Prefab is it really all takes place way before the Beatles were even an idea. So the story focuses on a gentleman named Colin Hanton, who was John Lennon's, you know, friend, you know, childhood friend, a drummer in his high school band, you know, their very first band they ever put together. And, get to know and understand the story from his perspective, because he is really the only one on Earth that was there the day John met Paul and the day that Paul introduced everyone to George. And he was there to witness, you know, their skiffle group, their little folk skiffle group transition from skiffle music to rock and roll. So it's a neat journey to go on with him. And again, you know, he's in his 80s and just alive and kicking and just full of life. And it's just a very unique individual. I mean, the only one that can tell that story that was there, you know, the day it all happened. And I'm looking at a picture right now in my office here of the very first concert that the Quarrymen did. And this, what's cool about this picture is John Lennon's like the only one really looking at you. And this photo was taken like an hour before he meets Paul McCartney. So when you think about that, it's like, when he really puts it in perspective of just the, you know, what was about to happen, you know, just an hour from the moment this photo was snapped.
one of the jokes I tell the kids. Funny. They're like, if you could time travel, what would you do? And I'm like, I'd go discover the Beatles.
Yeah.
Obviously. Carol wants to know if you've seen the movie Yesterday, and she's curious what you thought of it, if you did.
I did see it. In fact, we were the next crew to come through Liverpool after they shot Yesterday at the church there, especially. I love the movie. I thought it was cute. Just a great, you know, out of a box kind of concept. So I'm a big fan of movies like that for sure. But it was a great movie.
I was going to say, I really liked Across the Universe for the same reason, but people were like, whoa, that's, you know, you might as well say you like Star Wars more. You're going to get killed. You say that to some people.
It's your show. You say what you want, you know?
I like Across the Universe. I'm a Star Wars fan. I thought it was fun. I was actually a Trek guy. The reason I was into Trek, people ask me that question sometimes, is that Star Wars was, I'm a generally bleak person, but I really like the optimism in Trek. But that's the deal. Nicole, I want to talk to you about the art program, but I also want to, you know, kind of point out that, you know, you will probably have to say yes to being a guest a second time because you got a little book action coming out in the fall.
I do. Pre-order.
Back to Earth.
Go get it.
Back to Earth, which sounded like, here's what I thought. Here was my train of thought because, you know, I'm a really good researcher. You said your comment about Live Like Crew. I'm like, that is an awesome book title. She should write a book about that. I wonder if what she's written lately. And then I saw Back to Earth. I was like, well, that's probably in there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, Live Like Crew's. Okay.
Kind of overlaps the whole thing. I mean, really what we've talked about so far with respect to how, you know, we've brought this international community together in space and in a really challenging environment, right? To solve really challenging problems together. And the ways we do that, they just apply so perfectly down here on Earth to all of us as well. You know, this reminder that we live on a planet and all Earthlings, thin blue line, only border that matters kind of thing.
If the last year has taught us anything, it's that people are selfless and willing to cooperate when the stakes are really high.
Let's hope so. In the end.
In the end, maybe. Can you tell us a little bit about the Space Fart Foundation?
Will you stop it?
Absolutely. I know, Chris, we thought about the same thing actually when we named it, but it's like it still had to stick.
They're like, nobody would be that immature.
Everybody's that immature, I think. I think, you know, this is something I had the opportunity to paint while I was in space, which is like this human, I don't know. And there's been music and art in space since the very beginning. I think about it like bringing the human to human spaceflight. And I knew when I retired from NASA that I was going to paint, do my own artwork and try to share the experience I'd had through that, you know, in that way and engage perhaps people that don't even know we have a space station or that all these things are happening in space that are about life on Earth. And got introduced to an artist who had been the founder of an art medicine program at a hospital in Houston. We created one art spacesuit that's become five suits. This suit Exploration was built with artwork from kids in over 50 countries, hospitals, refugee centers. And our tagline, I think, is what says it all. You know, we're uniting a planetary community of children through the awe and wonder of space exploration and the healing power of art. And I honestly, through this work, I feel like I've found my next mission. Like I went to space and did the stuff there so that I could come back to Earth and work on these projects with these kids around the world. You know, space is a thing. I think it comes through the Woman in Motion film too, you know, is that there's inspiration there and this idea of space exploration and kind of lifting ourselves up, whether it's, you know, in our own lives or off the planet or to explore, that can give hope. And that's what we're trying to do for these kids in these places. And it's incredible to see how these children going through what you hope is the worst thing they ever have to deal with in their lives can be lifted up themselves to kind of transcend that experience, think about their futures, talk about what they're going through compared to being an astronaut. It's just, I get goosebumps every time I think about it. And if I could do nothing other than working on these art spacesuits, that would be it.
You know, the two of you are making me feel like, what have I done with my life?
Not a lot.
Just interviewed people. That's all.
That's true. Yeah. Interview people about what they're doing. That's amazing.
Shake people down.
I learn something new every single day. And it's why I love doing this show. And today has been just outstanding for that. So I'm really loving it. You guys got to go check out this movie.
Do.
Yeah.
Emotion.
It's so good. It's so good.
So much to cover there.
You'll laugh. You'll cry.
We have a few things we have left to do on the show before we kick everybody out and make you go back to doing something far less entertaining than us.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
So, person of the day is assigned absolutely by capricious interest of myself. So I just sort of decide who I think is person of the day. I had one, which was, oh, Carrie, I know what I'm going to do. Coach Scott Woodard, six-time person of the day.
We have to get him a velvet smoking jacket.
Velvet smoking jacket. Coming your way, Coach Woodard. He's been made person of the day more than probably any other audience participant. And
he's like, take me out of contention. I'm hugging it.
He didn't even want to be in he doesn't even want to run for it anymore. So we have a question we ask every single guest who's on here. And obviously, you have very finite space in space. So you can only bring some potatoes and some sand in case you get stuck like Mark.
And some ketchup. Don't forget the ketchup.
Happened to Matt Damon. So we're going to ask you some questions, which are what goes in your backpack? Thank you, Nancy. The question is, it could be something physical, because something metaphorical. So it could be something like potato seeds, or it could be potato seeds. It could be something like, that's not how any of this works.
What? You don't know science.
My grandpa was a potato farmer too. Or it could be something metaphorical, like, hope. The future of the little people or something. Carrie, what's a good metaphorical one?
Kindness.
Oh, that's a great one. And what's something physical you could put in a backpack?
A book you hate, because if it's the only book you have with you, eventually you're going to read it and learn something from it.
Nice. I could imagine in those space vehicles, those magazines must be so old by now.
Like the 1997 Cosmopolitan.
The one in the toilet, it's like, self. what's her face? I had a bad joke. Anyway, also related to
when you're gonna have a good one, let me know.
Nicole was part of the first ever tweet up in space, because in case you're not nerdy enough to be an astronaut, you are tweeting in space.
It's tough with those big gloves.
All right. Yeah. So here's our question. Let's start with director Todd Thompson. What goes in your backpack, sir?
Oh my God. I'm going to have to definitely just go with the essentials, your hygiene products, because I've been caught more times than not, like, on the road. And I wish I had just those little extra, the survival guide stuff.
Like a comb.
like a comb and like a toothbrush. And, you never know when your day is going to go a little longer than you expected it. But also, I would also, not to steal your thunder, but I would definitely pack it with hope too, because I just feel, with hope, anything's possible. And if we can learn to rely on each other and really embrace each other, I think with hope, anything's possible. No matter what the challenges come our way, no matter what obstacles we have to overcome. I think one of my favorite parts of this whole Star Trek journey for me has been learning what IDIC really means, infinite diversity, infinite combinations. And the minute, we truly understand what that means, and we truly respect and appreciate what everyone brings to the table, I think sky's the limit.
Really good answer. And I also like the thought that, it's like a comb and this very important hope.
Yeah.
Well, you gotta be practical.
Be
practical. Also, you're not stealing any answers from us, Todd, because all the answers we give are answers actual guests have given in the past. So
that could have been Sir Mix-a-Lot for all you know. That might have been his answer.
It was. I forget. Kindness was the burlesque performer Ariel Helvetica.
Yeah,
and you're book on you a... hate was Whiskey Nate, who goes around, he bums around the country taking photos of whiskey bottles like against scenic vistas. That's what he does for a living.
Yeah, the whiskey is his reward for having climbed XYZ mountain or whatever, mm-hmm. and then you get to see him enjoy it. So artist and sometimes astronaut Nicole Stott, what do you put in your backpack?
Well, I think it's the same things I wanted to take to space with me. and one of them I got to take to space with me. The other I didn't. The one is a watercolor kit. Because I think it's, when we're in these places that are I don't know, just where you think it's going to be special, where there's going to be some surprise. It's nice to be able to, you know, get a little bit of that down creatively. And I had the opportunity to do that in space, which was on its own surprising. But the other is my family and my husband, my son, and my two dogs. That's, we'll make that a combo unit there. And that's if I could have had them in space, it would have been awesome. You know,
maybe next time, Nicole, because before I bet they were like, they'll never survive like months up there all shut in together. And you're like, the last year.
Yeah, we know now. Yeah,
we could do it. We could do it.
Yeah. And I feel like any day now, Virgin Galactic is going to make that offer. You know, Richard Branson, you know, you come up to his hotel for a little bit. It'll be fun.
Yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And I, you know, I'm just going to steal both of you. You know, the hope and kindness thing, I think if we apply that to everything we do, there's a motto that goes along with this idea we've been talking about this whole show of, you know, believing that there's a solution to every challenging problem. And it's one I learned pretty much on my first day at NASA at Kennedy Space Center, which is here's how we can, not why we can't. And I think that that's just such a positive way to look at everything. And if you build a little hope and kindness into that, it comes out better for everyone, right? And so I think that's where I would go with it.
You have an engineering degree, though. So I started laughing. You have an engineering degree. You know that every engineer who sees that sign goes, what? Because engineers are the only people on the earth. Like they shouldn't be allowed to fly commercial airplanes. Because they'd be like, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to die. I just saw a red light. And I'm pretty sure we're going to fucking die. And then the next thing you know, it's like, oh, never mind. It's fine.
You have about 35 seconds.
It's the worst. You know, worst case, first case. That's how it works.
Yeah, you know, everyone I've worked with, it's been about
Todd went
improving life on Earth. Todd. Anyway, most of them have something really creative going on too, which has been a beautiful surprise along the way too.
He was told this was going to be a very brief show. he's mad because I cussed. Either one, I can't tell. You know, growing up and having strong female leads, I would say one of the people that was strongest in my life was my grandmother. And, you know, she was never awarded the opportunity to be an astronaut. But when it comes to creativity, I can tell you she did a really kind of weird, crazy thing with pipe cleaners that relates to space. It was this experiment. And you have to have